I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
If you're a regular listener of the Motherly podcast, you've probably heard a few of our guests suggest that the way to thrive as a family is to take a bit of pressure off of ourselves and to learn about how to say no. It is a modern paradigm, right? To focus all of our attention, all of our resources, all of our free time, really, on making our kids happy. This is a really modern concept. It's one that I can easily fall into. I mean, lately, our sons wanted to play football this fall. So 4 to 5 days a week after work, my husband or I are schlepping with all the equipment and spending all of our nights at a football field. We're doing it because our sons really want to do it. But I have to say, it has taken up a lot of our free time and a lot of that space that I might have spent on myself or spending time with my husband or just unwinding. I am wondering about what a different paradigm for parenting could look like. Many of our guests who have found a new sense of freedom within parenthood have presented a different way of looking at family life, which is that the adults are sort of at the top of the pyramid and not the children. To me, meaning that we are all a unit and it is just as important and maybe more important that the adults get their needs met and that the children are helping in the running of the household, as opposed to the way I know my house is usually run, which is we're all in this to focus on the kids. There's nothing wrong with making sure that our kids are happy and fulfilled. But I do think when that happens at the expense of your relationship with your partner, your relationship with yourself, it's time to start questioning that. Hey, Mama. Welcome to the Motherly podcast. I am Liz Tennedy, the co-founder of Motherly, and I am also a mom of four myself. I'm super excited to share today's episode with you, which is a conversation with Dr. Maiklene Duclef. You might have heard of her before. She has a new New York Times best-selling book out called Hunt, Gather, Parent. Maiklene is also an NPR global health correspondent, and she describes in her book a way of raising helpful and confident kids that parents have actually turned to for millennia. And she shows us how we can incorporate these principles and philosophies into our own lives. To write the book, Maiklene traveled to 3 continents with her 3-year-old daughter, Rosie, along as her sidekick. Maya, Inuit, and Hadzabi families showed her and Rosie how to tame tantrums, motivate kids to be helpful, and build children's confidence and self-sufficiency. I have to say, this book really made an impression on me. I gave it to my husband to read. He read it. It really turned a lot of our modern parenting paradigms on their head and showed me that things that are everyday battles in our household and I'm sure in many other households around the country and the world don't have to be battles. It really reshaped how I think about really family life in a very basic and foundational way. I found it so liberating, so helpful, and really a way to start a conversation with my husband, with the people who help raise our kids, our families, extended families. It's really been one of the most illuminating parenting books I've ever read. So I'm thrilled to share our conversation today with you. Dr. Maiklene Duklef, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I just finished reading your book, and I have to tell you, I find myself almost reeling in a good way, because your book deeply shifts the paradigm about parenting in the way that you set ancient cultures against what we all kind of take for granted in the air of what it means to raise kids in America, in the West. But I guess perhaps I wanted to anchor this at the beginning in, why did you set off on this literal journey as a reporter? And what do you think is the main thread that you learned in your travels and also your sort of inner work of trying to learn and unlearn some of the parenting lessons you were taught?
I think it was really an accident. NPR sent me down to the Yucatan, to a little Maya village, for a totally different story, for a story about children's attention. But while I was down there, the moms there just showed me such a better way to interact with children than I had ever seen before. I was not expecting it at all. And I think I felt like you felt for like months after that trip. I was just like, what did I just see? And like, is it real? Like, could parenting really be that like almost easy and enjoyable? Like I point out in the book, one of the most striking things there was how helpful the kids were. They were genuinely helpful to their parents, helpful to their siblings. For instance, one morning I was talking to this mom, Maria Tumborgas. We were in our kitchen. She has three daughters and two sons. And the oldest daughter, who's 12, was on spring break, and she woke up pretty late and she walked past us and just started doing the dishes. And Maria wasn't even surprised. She was just like, well, you know, she's 12 and she should know what she should do. And I was like, wow, what is like going on? Like, kids would get off their bikes and like go help their moms. There was no bickering or negotiating. I was just like, I genuinely want to learn about this. And perhaps what I've been taught and how I was raised may not be the like easiest, most effective approach. And then I kind of let it be, even though I couldn't find anything in parenting, like very little in parenting books about this Maya parenting, whatever it was. And then I went, NPR sent me up to the Arctic for another story, again, about anger this time, not about parenting, but I saw a really similar approach to parenting in a very calm, confident approach, kind, respectful kids, very helpful. And I started digging around more and I started to realize, oh, this is actually a really common way of interacting with children that I'm noticing, and that parents all over the world, every livable continent, have turned to over and over again, because I think a lot of it really works. And it's kind of the way children are built to be parented. And so this book was about me trying to learn this approach firsthand with my little girl, Rosie. She was three at the time. We traveled back to the Yucatan, back to the Arctic. And then we also went to Tanzania, where there's this incredible hunter-gatherer group called the Hadzabe, who have very intentionally preserved a lot of their traditional way of living. And with that comes a valuing and a preservation of the parent-child relationship. And so hunt-gather-parent really is about me trying to learn this approach from the moms and dads and what they taught me and how that changed my relationship with what I call like a raging maniac of a child. And, you know, me and Rosie started off just really as enemies. Constant power struggles. I like dreaded my time with her. It was really sad. It was really hard in our home. And we end up in such a different place. And I just felt like these techniques and this approach really helped me. And I think it could help a lot of parents, even just adding a little bit of it into your life.
Mm-hmm. So I'm at the beginning of that journey. And I think your book kind of gave me and our family a lot to think about. But again, the observations you make about ancient cultures that are well and alive today in the world through these three communities, they really contrast with what you call, others call, weird Western cultures. And again, I think it's critical for all of us to recognize that the culture that we live in is a culture. It's not the only culture. It's not the only way. And so we can all take for granted that parenting is hard and it's about these power struggles, but we have to also kind of reflect on that there's a unique Western, quote, weird paradigm that we're all living in. And so only when we kind of understand what makes the culture that we're in unique can we kind of contrast that to these other alive ancient cultures and start to learn where we can all make changes on the family level and on the social, cultural level.
Yeah, that was very well put.
So what does weird mean? We got to start there.
So weird is a term that a group of psychologists coined. It stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. So really Western Europe, Canada, US, Australia. And what they noticed is that if you look at how people perform in psychological tests, so not just parenting, but any psychological study, these people in the West, this weird group, this weird culture, actually kind of stick out from the rest of the world. So psychologically, we have some very unique, that we say weird or strange kind of qualities, and our minds work a little bit differently than kind of the rest of the world. And likely this is also unique throughout time. 2,000 years ago, we probably weren't functioning this way, even like 500 years ago. And what this group of researchers noticed is that we take those qualities, and a lot of times in science, scientists take those qualities and think that they're universal, that this is how everyone's brain works. But in fact, they're very unique and strange. And an anthropologist, David Lancy, at the same time was figuring this out when it comes to parenting and realizing that a lot of the things that we do, he has a list of like 50 or 60 things we do that no other culture does. So overpraising children, just this constant stream of praise, is incredibly strange. And one of the researchers told me, this is like an experiment we're doing on our kids. We have no clue how this praise, I mean, we're starting to understand how the praise affects them, but this is a brand new experiment. And we're talking now about 20 years old. Toys. Toys are crazy. So like a lot of cultures, parents will make kids a little doll, or they'll show the kids, like when we were at the Hadzabe, the dads would make the boys toy arrows, but they actually kind of function too. So, you know, parents would make kids a few toys out of what's around, and that's it. Otherwise, kids would make their own toys and their own games. And even, this is like 150 years ago in America, like every kid, no matter the economic level, rich, poor, everything in between, every race, parents did not give their kids toys. Kids made their own toys. And this kind of goes in line with this idea that we have to keep kids busy. So we have to entertain them. We have to schedule things. We have to create these child-centered activities that are just for them. And God forbid we could just spend 6 or 7 hours on a Saturday without telling the kid what to do at all and just go about our business. And like the kid just figures it out. And in fact, a lot of kids really enjoy that. So this is very strange too. This idea that it's the parent's job to like teach, stimulate, or entertain a child basically at every moment. And this is something that started off probably about 150 years ago, but it's just ballooned in the last 20, 30 years.
So I just want to talk about some of the parenting characteristics that we all live on a day-to-day basis that are, quote, weird when you talk about this acronym we take for granted. One of them is the supremacy of the nuclear family, right?
Yes.
Huge.
So the nuclear family fits portrayed in the media and a lot of places as the ideal family structure, unless people will call it traditional family structure. But in fact, it's not even close to that. So it's something that's come about in the last few hundred years, only in Western culture. And I should point out there's many cultures in the US where the nuclear family is not the functional unit. Mm-hmm. But if you look all around the world, and throughout human history, this is not how children have been raised. And in fact, there's good evolutionary biological evidence that human children have evolved to be raised by a group of about 4 or 5 people. And this can be usually multi-generational. So an older person, a neighbor, a friend, a relative, younger person, so kids, teenagers, and then, you know, a handful of middle-aged adults. Basically, human children are born incredibly helpless. One of the very unique human things is that a human baby, if you just stuck it out in the wild, like it would just
not make it.
It would not make it, right. Incredible. So it takes something like 12 to 18 years for the child to become self-sufficient. This is unheard of across primates even. And with that, one of the evolutionary biologists, Sarah Bluffer Hardy, she's done all this incredible research where she's shown that the only way that humans could have made it through the past 200, 300,000 years of evolution is if the mother had an enormous amount of help raising a child, and then not to mention 2, 3 children. And so there's just no way that the mom could get enough calories for the child, but also just have enough time on her hands to take care of such helpless children. And so she estimates that children need and are designed to be raised by about 4 or 5 very close caretakers, caretakers that are as close as I am to my daughter. And if you look around the world, this is how most families function. There is a lot of help. And the mom and the dad play a much smaller role in the child, especially after about 2 years old, than these other people. So in some hunter-gatherer communities, the mom is like 20% of the time. Which actually, if you think about it, that's kind of what I give my daughter, right? Because she goes to preschool and daycare full time. So I'm about a 20%er, you know? That's how it's kind of designed to be done, right? And when it goes up to 50, 60, 75%, I kind of start losing my mind.
Enter a pandemic. I think all of us are noticing the truth that we are designed to be raising children in community. So I think you've kind of convinced us that there's something really unusual about the way that we do child rearing in the West. And I know our listeners are so aware of the statistics around how burned out mothers are. It is clear that the state of American motherhood is not working. And you knew that yourself, right? I mean, you were having this real struggle with raising your daughter. So you ended up not only writing a book, but bringing your daughter along to explore three different cultures.
So we first went to the Yucatan, and it was kind of a hot mess of a nightmare because even the flight, I think it was like 6 hours, I had no clue how to handle her at all. And it was painfully obvious to the parents, just like, this woman has no clue what she's doing.
Can you describe your parenting style, philosophy up until that point? What were you trying to do?
So, you know, I thought I was really like hands off. I thought I was this laissez-faire kind of, oh, go with the flow. But what I realized that I wasn't at all, and that I was actually really trying to control her a lot, her behavior, what she said, what she did. And this would create these big power struggles. And then she'd end up having a tantrum. And then I would start yelling at her, and we'd get in this kind of really awful, horrific cycle. And then she'd end up like hitting me or biting me. So I think I was just like kind of the standard white American mom. I was worried about her getting hurt a lot of the time. I was very anxious. I was on point at every moment, you know, really paying attention. And towards the end of the book, we talk about like counting the commands or instructions that I gave her. You know, I was giving her something like every 10 or 15 seconds, especially in environments that were unknown. And, you know, when we got to the little village, things were a little different. But I have to say, when we first got there, it was painfully obvious that I was not knowing what I was supposed to do with her. But the other kids actually were incredibly kind. This little 9-year-old, Helme, came in, and she had known me from the previous trip. And she came in and she said, oh, you know, what's your name? She was kind of talking in Spanish. And she took Rosie and they went off to the playground. And for the first, you know, time, really, I could just let go. These kids were incredibly well skilled at taking care of younger kids. And they went to the playground and there was a 16-year-old there, a 12-year-old, a 9-year-old. Just watching this group of kids take her under the wing, and I could tell they were really good at taking care of her. They really cared a lot. I really, for the first time, like kind of could let go and be a little bit like, they're not other moms, but they're like incredibly good babysitters. And I could feel that kind of like you're talking about, like a community of people helping each other and looking after each other. There is where I really started to see this really calm approach to children, and how the moms, especially one of the moms we stayed with, Juanita, how whenever Rosie was really kind of charged and screaming and having a tantrum, this mom would just be incredibly calm and not really say anything to her, but just kind of stand there. And this was something I saw everywhere we went, and something I especially learned up in the Arctic. But on the way back home on that 6-hour flight, I was really trying to have this and bring this to my parenting. And I started to see it working. I started to see like, oh, if I'm like really calm, and I don't say anything. And in fact, if I just kind of ignore her, not walk away and not be mean, but just kind of smile a little bit and nod and just be this very calm presence, she really calms down. It's incredibly powerful.
Is there a prevalent or dominant characteristic of Mayan parenting?
So in the book, I say, you know, my style of parenting was like a white knuckle ride on Cat 5 Rapids. Like it was just, you know, whoa. And like, you know, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but high energy. And the Maya approach really is like, you're in this wide, calm, very shallow river, kind of meandering through a valley. I've been criticized for overstating this, but I'm telling you, I'm not. I am not. And it has been well documented by researchers that there is this incredible calm presence. And what I've learned is that this is very common around the world. And what parents are doing is that they're teaching the child and the children to be calm themselves. And they're showing them that this is what maturity and growing up is bringing this calmness. The other thing is they're incredibly skilled at watching children. One time we were at this cenote, this like swimming hole, which is this beautiful place, but incredibly dangerous. Like if Rosie had fallen in, I mean, it would have been over. And she was wearing a life jacket at first and everything. And then at the end, she kind of took it off and we were sitting by the edge. And I was thinking like, wow, this is actually really a dangerous moment. And I kind of got up to leave and I was going to call her like I usually, you know, very verbal. And I turned around for a split second. And this mom who had been there that I hadn't even noticed was there. She was standing there watching and she came out and grabbed Rosie's hand and said to me like in Spanish, like, this is dangerous. And so she was like sitting there. She wasn't telling me what to do. She wasn't telling Rosie what to do. She was just watching us and making sure we were safe. And I talk a lot about this in the book. This is the way that they give kids a lot of autonomy and independence is that they step back and they allow children to explore and test things out. And really, the child thinks, and just like I did, thinks that they're on their own and doing this themselves, but actually somebody is there watching and only steps in when that is really needed.
Jeannie said, I'm glad they were there too, because I'm getting anxiety hearing about it. There was also an element that you brought up about the way that not only do they include children in chores in a conventional way, right? Oh, your kid gets older and they take more responsibility. But you're right, the first step is counterintuitive. You have to do almost the exact opposite of what you think makes sense. You have to turn tasks over to the least competent family member in the home. So this is the exact opposite of how I parent. We have a almost two-year-old who is our youngest of four. He's so challenging. My husband and I are like exasperated, right? It's like living with a raccoon. He's in the garbage. He's opening the drawers. He's like climbing up the fireplace. Like it's wild.
Sounds familiar.
But thinking about, okay, he's curious. He's fun. And the counterintuitive step isn't for me to take him away when I need to clean. It's to decide, as the Mayans do, that this is the time to channel that to, okay, I'm not cleaning up after you. We're going to clean together. I'm going to take the time now to teach you what it means to be a responsible citizen alongside me and not make it separate domains of responsibility. And so talk our listeners through how that gradual but also counterintuitive training of kids comes in and what happens when you start that early.
Yeah, and I have to say this is like super common. It's been really well documented with Mayan and indigenous groups in Mexico, but you can find it really, you know, anywhere. First of all, your little boy, a lot of parents, including a lot of Maya parents, would say he really wants to help. Him coming in and with the garbage or whatever he's doing, like he wants to take the garbage out. I was actually talking to a researcher. She's a Mexican-American researcher in Southern California, and she has a two-year-old. And she was telling me the little one comes over and starts throwing the laundry everywhere. And she's like, that's her folding the laundry. She's trying to fold the laundry, right? So the different mindset is that I would see the little kid as like making a mess, slowing me down, being just a pain in the butt. And I would shoo her off and tell her to go play.
And it would frustrate us. And then we're also angry and agitated.
Exactly. And we're yelling at them. Or I would just wait to do it after she's sleeping because I just didn't want to deal with it.
To make your life harder, right?
Exactly.
That's what you're doing with your free time now, cleaning up after her.
Exactly. Instead of taking a break. But a lot of parents view that behavior very pro-socially. And they would say, this child really wants to help. Okay, they're making a mess. It kind of makes me mad, but I'm excited that he's showing interest. They would say like he's screaming for responsibility, right? For instance, Rosie was climbing on the roof a couple weeks ago. And I was like, I could scream at her. I could go up there and drag her down. And I finally said, Rosie, can you do us a favor? Can you go to run up to the store? And this is like a couple blocks away and it's a big deal for her to go. And she got back down off the roof and she like, yes, mama, I want to go to the store. And then her behavior was so much better for 3 or 4 days after this. She wanted responsibility. And so starting very little, and this is true in many cultures. I saw this with the Hadzabe, especially too. From the time the child can walk, parents will tell you, you include them in any task you want them to do later in life without nagging and bribing. You include them very early on, especially if they show interest, and interest being exactly what you're talking about, jumping in full force. And you give them these little tiny tasks to do that really make a difference. So the little one, you can say, this is how we get the clothes in the basket. Can you put the clothes in the basket, or hand them some folded clothes and say, put them in the drawer? So these tasks that insanely small, but what they're doing is they're teaching the child to work together with you and cooperate with you, which is something I think we've kind of lost. But they're also allowing the child to contribute. And this is what the Maya parents are like masters at, allowing the child to actually make a difference in the task in the home. This is something I was horrible at. So Rosie would come in and try to help me in the kitchen, and I started including her after reading and traveling. But then I would jump in with my hands and try to, no, that's not right. You know, you need to like cut it like this, or no, that's all wrong. You know, just like, you know, the way I've been taught. But what this does is completely demotivate children. You know, you wouldn't like it, right, if somebody did that to you. But instead, a lot of parents would just step back, let the child try, and then kind of guide the child. Oh, can you cut them a little bit smaller? Or I try to do it like this. And then they accept the child's contribution, which is huge. Rosie and I were getting in so many fights because I would just ignore whatever she did. I have a story in the book where we made kebabs and she was making them differently than me. And I was just like it was the biggest deal in the world I was making about it. I was like, the kebabs can't be like that, which is so silly, right? Like, it's just chicken kebabs. And then I realized it. I was like, wow, I'm not cooperating with her. So I tried it again and she made some funky kebab and I just took it and put it on the plate. And it was like night and day. She wanted to help more. She was happy. Like, these kebabs worth an argument? That was actually a big lesson I learned. One of the moms in the Arctic, Elizabeth Tugumiak, you know, she told me, she's like, is this worth a conflict? And it's something that has just stuck with me. Are the conflicts that I've been having with Rosie really worth it?
I want to talk a little bit more about what you learned with the Inuit in the Arctic, that certainly ones that stood out to me. But if you could give me your summary of their unique parenting philosophy, but also if there's commonalities that you are also starting to see.
Yeah. So again, incredible calmness. I mean, even more. So there's been a lot of anthropological research about how many Inuit families, like, they never yell at children. And I kind of didn't believe it. Like, never yell a child. I mean, we're also talking about families that were living in very small, confined homes in the winter in a blizzard, and never yell, never scold. But it's absolutely true. Like, we spent 2 weeks with a family that had 5 or 6 grandkids that were in and out of the house, and never once did a parent yell at a child. And Rosie actually knocked over a cup of coffee across the room on this white rug. And, you know, I was like, oh my God, like, I just almost lost it. And the grandmother turned to her son, who's 21, and said, your coffee was in the wrong place. She blamed the adult, basically, and that you should have been aware that the child was going to do this. But after about 10 days there, I was like, wow, nobody has yelled at any kid. Nobody has yelled at anybody. So this is the key thing, I think. The other thing is that the Inuit, again, just like the Mayan, include the children. And they have these incredibly sophisticated ways of doing it. So for instance, seal hunting is a big deal and it requires incredible patience. The men go out, and now the women too, they go out and they dig these tiny little holes in the ice and they stand there, basically they put this little feather in it and they stand there for like hours until they see the feather move and then they catch the seal. And I asked one of the dads, I said, you know, the kids can't do that, right? You have to be really quiet. And he's like, well, we train them. And I was like, well, how do you train them? And he's like, well, we take them out with another kid and we tell them, okay, you have to be really quiet, and we park the sled far away and then they have to sit there and wait for us. And they're like far enough away that if they yell, they won't mess it up, and they have to learn to sit there for like 6 hours in the sled. And then, you know, as they get quieter and quieter, we move them closer and closer, and the reward is actually getting to be there and catch the seal. And so they have these ways of just like slowly training children into the adult world, and with these incredible skills of patience and kindness and flexibility. But definitely they are masters of teaching children to control their emotions. They are like masters of stopping tantrums.
It's almost that the calmness becomes contagious. I was reading about mirror neurons, and it was not in the context of parenting, but I immediately recognize that what I'm bringing to a situation, it's biology. Like, they cannot help but feel the stress that I'm exuding. And so you paint this picture of the parent as calm in the storm, But that ultimately that invites the kids to see that modeled, to practice that themselves. It's hard, yeah. but it's worth it. It's easy to say, but it does work, especially in the long term, right? There's a process to all of this.
Yeah. What the science kind of tells us is, like you say, we have these mirror neurons where we mimic somebody else's emotion. And I think children are especially good at it, right? For their parents, right?
Exactly.
Which makes sense. And you're right. Like, it's really hard and there's some tricks to it, I think. But once I saw the way Rosie responded to it, I was like, oh gosh, this is the way. Because the other thing it does is that if you're not actively settling the child down, all you're doing is being calm and there. You're not walking away and ignoring small children. They don't do that. Older children, they will. Like if they think the child is capable of calming themselves down, they'll turn around and walk away. But this is like 6, 7, 8-year-olds. And it depends on the situation. If they think the child needs help, they want, right? But for the little ones, they don't walk away. They're there. So the child knows you're there and can help them. And just being there is huge. But they don't actively try to stop the child and tell the child to stop. Instead, they show the child the motion and the behavior that's right. And I saw this happen with Rosie over and over again. And yeah. what happens is then she learns to settle herself down. It's not you doing it, it's her doing it. And so it becomes this like practice for her. And once I really started getting better at it, Rosie went from having like a tantrum every other day to like one or two a month. Like it was really incredible. And the science backs it, you know, that this idea that like if you practice at it, your brain gets better and better at going from this state of like excited, like really stressed. One of the psychologists told me like the kid is super stressed, right? To like being calm. And that's like a lifelong skill, right? To have, to be able to do it. I couldn't do it before this writing this book.
I mean, it made me realize how can I expect my kids to be rational and calm and overcome their frustrations if we're not coming to them that way, if we're coming to them with the opposite.
Right. And sometimes it's good intention. It's like, are you okay? What's wrong? Like it's a very like positive, but it's still high energy, right? And I think all they feel is the energy and the stress that you're bringing. But there is like a trick to it because I thought at first it was like suppressing my anger towards her. And once I'm in that state, like bringing it down, which it's somewhat that. But I think a lot of parents around the world actually have a lot less anger toward children. They just come with a lot less. And I think the key is that there's a different mindset. So we often say that children are like pushing our buttons. They're manipulating us. They're trying to control us. So we have a very kind of negative, nefarious view of children's behavior. And I said this to one of the moms in the Arctic, this incredible woman, Lisa Ipoli. I said, you know, but she's manipulating me. She's pushing boundaries. And the woman just laughed at me. She was 2 at the time. She was like, no, she's 2 years old. Like, she's not doing that. She's not this like evil person, this like CEO businessman that's trying to like get something from you. She's like, you know, she's just a child and she's irrational and she's illogical. And it's your job to show her how to be calm and teach her how to be calm. I mean, the truth is we don't know if children are manipulating us and pushing our buttons. These are just kind of myths we've created in our minds that get propagated from one generation to the next. But it could be completely not true. In fact, I don't think it's true. Because when I started asking Rosie, so she would hit me and I would say, you know, I used to get mad. But then I started saying what I learned from one of the moms in the Arctic. I started saying, do you not like me? Because, you know, if you're hitting me, you must not like me, you know. And at first she was like, she didn't really know what to say. But after a couple of weeks, she was like, no, mama, I love you. You know, like, yeah, it was just so sweetest thing. And I was like, well, you know, when you hit me, it makes me think you don't like me because you're hurting me. And she just didn't understand what the implications of it were. And so I've stopped taking Rosie's bad behavior personally, and I've started to just expect it. So a lot of parents just expect a child to have a tantrum, expect them to act like a raging maniac. And so why would you get upset? Getting upset and angry is just going to teach them to get upset and angry. And several of the moms even said, you know, I've seen kids up here where I know the parents yell at them and argue with them because the children yell and argue. It's this just this cycle we're creating.
I am definitely creating cycles that I need to unlearn. Another one that I found really interesting from your trip to Tanzania was what you observed about community and specifically the difference between what autonomy is and what independence is. Like, I think in America, we all think we want to raise independent kids. I know that's something I've thought before. We're getting to a point now, though, where my kids are like, well, what's in it for me? This is the breaking point of our parenting with our older kids. They're like, well, I'm not going to help
how does that help me?
And right. I'm like, what have I done wrong that that is where we are? But I think it's erring on the side of independence versus autonomy in the context of a community. And you saw that at play.
Yeah. So in a lot of hunter-gatherer communities, autonomy or independence, both of them are incredibly valued. People have the right to make their own decisions from moment to moment. And that right is also given to little children, tiny little toddlers. And telling people what to do is really rude. But that said, autonomy is where you have that right to make decisions and you're not telling other people what to do, but you are constantly looking out to help each other. So there's this kind of constant inward look towards the group. So the kids are trained very early on and expected to share. So if you get something and you out foraging or somebody gives you something, you immediately share it first before even like a little five-year-old. So in the book, I give this little five-year-old Bailey a muffin. And before she took a bite of it, she gave her little baby brother she ended up giving the baby brother almost the entire muffin. It was incredible. I was like, would I even do that? Like, you know, she's been taught that. So she has huge amounts of autonomy. She can do basically what she wants all the time, but she's taking care of her little brother. One day when we went out to get water, she climbed up this cliff and foraged and got this huge bowl of baobab seeds for everyone to eat for lunch. She's constantly thinking of the group and how she can help the group. And I think this is kind of a little bit what's missing, because we teach kids to go after what they want and achieve what they want, which is great. But at the end of the day, we also want them to help the family, help learn to cooperate. So Rosie kind of summed it up. She's like, everyone can do what they want, but they have to help, share, and be kind. And I think the limitations of independence is wrapped around kind of this expectation that you're going to be helpful and you're going to give back to the group. The kids are taught very early on with practice and modeling to share whatever they get, to help each other out when it comes to the other kids. So when you're out playing, you help the little ones, you pay attention and make sure they're safe. And then they're taught, like, if the parent needs something and the parent asks you, you do it. And this is actually way easier than we think. I kind of realized, like, wow, I'm making it so hard. Basically, to teach a kid this, it's like you're just doing something and the kid's standing there or nearby and you just ask them to help with something super tiny. So like, I'm in the kitchen doing the dishes and it's like, Rosie, grab the glasses from the living room and bring them in. Or Rosie, go grab something from upstairs. Kids love to go get stuff. So this is teaching the child to pay attention, like, oh, the dishes need to come in. Or you're cleaning up the living room. Go grab the vacuum. Go plug the vacuum in. So these very little tiny tasks that actually help you and make things easier. These are constantly added into a child's life. One of the moms said, you know, whatever you do, the child is included, but very small, very simple. And you get much less resistance than asking for a big task.
It gives them a sense of belonging and accomplishment that instead of saying, oh, go do the dishes, it's, hey, let's clean the kitchen up. Could you wipe the counter down? Like one small right. thing that they can contribute. Oh, looks really nice now. Thank you.
Yeah. One parent told me, you know, like you got to make it quick because they don't have good attention. They're not in it for the long run. And then they see their contribution, right? Like, oh, I really helped and mom really needed it. And it makes them feel good. They want to help you. That is the lesson of the book, is they want to help you. They just don't know. They don't know how. And if they haven't been included, they've kind of lost a little bit of the desire, but the flame is in there. You just have to fan it.
Well, you have developed this acronym to summarize what these ancient cultures do. It's TEAM, T-E-A-M. Could you walk us through what those four are?
The first one is togetherness, which sounds like nightmarish to many people, but
especially at the end of a pandemic.
Yes, exactly. The idea is that a lot of times American parents want kids to do things by themselves. Go clean your room. You know, we focus on independence. But when we do this, we are really going against kids' natural instincts to work together and do things together. Now, togetherness does not mean the mom or the dad is entertaining and instructing the child. It is literally just having the child be present. So you going about your life. So Saturdays and Sundays, you doing what you want and allowing the child to be there with you. It also doesn't mean the mom and the dad always. In fact, like we talked about, like a lot of times it's not. It's just anybody who loves the child, a sibling, a neighbor, a friend, a nanny. It's just this idea that kids really are hardwired to be with us. And if we ever want them to do something, if you just say, let's do it together, they are like 10 times more likely to do it. It's a very calm, peaceful coexistence. What I've learned in the pandemic is that this way of parenting, you can do for 12, 13 hours a day. The previous way I could only do for like an hour.
I get it. That's hitting deep. So yes, I got to work on that. All right. So the first one is togetherness. Next is encourage. And,
yes.
And help us understand what's the difference between like giving too much praise and encouraging.
Yeah. So this actually is, you need the child to do some things. You want to teach them to be helpful, to share, to be kind. You want to teach them rules, right? To be safe. And we kind of force them, right? We want them to do it right now. We yell, we bribe. We do all these things to kind of force a child to do something. But the thing is nobody, adults, children like to be forced. If you try to force somebody to do something, you will often demotivate them and they will want to do the opposite. That said, you don't just throw up your hands and give up. There's all these tools to encourage the proper behavior. It's like a soft, gentle pressure that kind of tricks the child into thinking that they are doing it on their own by their own choice. And I think they're really useful for kids like Rosie who are really strong-willed and want to do it themselves. So there's just a whole list of stuff you can do, asking questions, telling stories. The book has a big chapter on encouraging. And then A is autonomy. I kind of summarize it like, you know, I recorded myself to figure out how many times I actually tell Rosie to do something or just give her any sort of verbal input. And I was clocking in at like over 60 an hour, like 100 an hour. It was just a constant barrage. And I didn't even realize I was doing this at all. But in Tanzania, I actually watched the parents and we're talking about like 1, 2, 3 times an hour, they will say something to a child. And this to me is really what autonomy is about. Just letting the child be and using those 1 or 2 commands an hour to teach them to be helpful or kind, ask them to go get something.
And minimize interference.
Yes, this is like a huge one. In America, we kind of maximize interference. I think that there's this feeling that the more you do as a parent, the better parent you are. That's how I felt. I'm kind of on guard and watching for like the next input to give her. And this is like a sign of really good parenting. But many, many cultures around the world, it's the opposite. It's like you're watching and you're paying really close attention, but you're only interfering when you actually really need to. And even then, it's a very gentle guidance. It's kind of like what I was talking about with the swimming hole where the mom was watching and really paying attention, but she only kind of stepped in when she felt like it was really needed.
Okay. It sounds amazing. And it also kind of gets me at this paradox because on the one hand, I can imagine that this kind of parenting, A, you suggest is kind of more built into our nature. And on the other hand, I can't help but think, but we live in a culture that is so different. And many of us, not all of us, but many of us have been trained in these parenting dynamics of power struggle and control, or we don't live with any allo parents, or we don't live near family. And in some ways, I think it might just begin with acknowledging the sort of science and the history of child rearing is, as you do in your book, and how different that is than our existing culture and structures. But how can parents start to inch towards this more ancient way of parenting, despite all of that, despite the fact that the structures and culture around us are not built for this kind of parenting? At least we think they're not.
It's a really good point. Well, for starters, I think a lot of it is about your relationship with the child, right? And I think that's why you see this approach in so many different environments and economies, because it is just a lot about how you relate to the child and approach the child. That said, it is overwhelming. And the stuff in the book, I've worked on the book for 4 years. And I still, like I said last weekend, one of the Inuit moms told me, you're going to always veer back to this crazy way. But what I will say is that adding even just a little bit of some of these things can make a really big difference. And some of the biggest changes I saw were early on. So one of the first things I did was cut out child-centered activities, birthday parties, kiddie museums, mostly because I hated them and I did not want to go to them anymore. And it took a while, actually, even though I didn't like them. But I just decided that, like, you know what? All the chores, all the things that I was doing while Rosie was sleeping or at school, those are the activities now. And she's going to be there. And if she's not involved, she's going to have to figure out something for herself. And this actually really improved our relationship because those activities were making her kind of crazy. And like she'd have these tantrums afterwards and they were making me crazy. And then I'd be resentful to her because I'm like, I just spent 4 hours at the museum and you're screaming at me. Like, like that, what is going on? That's not fair. So I'd say, look at what's in the book and be like, okay, what do you not enjoy as a parent? And then just drop that, you know? Like,
I couldn't agree more. You know, so many of our listeners, we've just been in survival mode for the last year. But I just said to my husband last night, let's have more fun. This isn't going to be enjoyable. It's not going to be what we wanted it to be as parents if it feels like a chore every day. And my husband recently started just going on walks every night. And sometimes he takes a kid with him. And it's great. He wants to go fishing, so he's going. And sometimes he takes a kid with him and sometimes he doesn't. But I think this thing about as parents that our world has to be child-centered is false. And it's making us unhappy. And it's not making our kids happy is the point in your book. It's not helping that either.
No. I think the other thing, actually during the pandemic, kind of towards the middle, we really started building the network of friends to help because we had no childcare for 6 months. And so now we have like a neighbor kid. He's like 8 or 7. And I've like fully trained him to really help with Rosie and he loves it. And then we also have a couple of families that we've just really heavily relied on. I hope we can hang on to this really more communal kind of childcare like you're talking about. Because this is so good for both the parents and the kid, right? It gives the parents a break. And it builds autonomy. But also, something we haven't mentioned is even just one extra adult in a kid's life that really cares about a kid and is connected protects a child from anxiety and depression and mental health issues. Like I said, our psychology is really made to be raised by several people. And that's what kids need to feel really good and safe and protected.
You do make a point in the book that I thought was really important, too, that it's not just about taking from our villages, but the villages that we do have in our lives. Like, how can we nurture those relationships as well and making sure those are priorities?
You know, we often think of like many, people say a village, but it really is like a few really good, deep friendships. And there's evidence that this is just as important as like not smoking, not drinking too much, getting enough exercise for our mental health. I think it's something that's overlooked so much is feeling like, okay, I'm having a problem. There's somebody that I can go to. And the reverse, that if someone's having a problem, I can help them. This idea of parents doing it on their own, it's crazy. A few Inuit moms were just like, you've been with your daughter like 24 hours. She must be sick of you. This is what they said. They were like, she's sick of you. You need help, lady. They just couldn't imagine me being by myself and traveling with her because it's just not the way, you know, it's impossible.
At Motherly, we believe that motherhood brings out our superpowers. Mm. I think of those as incredible talents. Incredible forces and powers within us, things that sometimes we didn't even know were there until we became mothers. So, Mycleen, I'm curious, what is your superpower?
I think Rosie kind of made me find like a better parenting method. And I think she brought out that superpower that I was able to go to these places and really see what these parents were doing and then not afraid to just try it.
Mycleen Duclef, thank you so much for joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure and an honor.
A lot of the times in our family, we do stuff for the kids, like we'll take you to school or we'll take you to football practice or to your friend's house. What would you think if instead of doing that, you guys just had to follow us around? Like you came with us to work and like to run our errands and just all the adult stuff. How would you, would you enjoy that? What do you think?
Well, if I would get all of the privileges that an adult would get, yes, I would like that. If I wouldn't, and I tried to follow you around, no, I wouldn't.
And what are the adult privileges?
Being able to do mostly everything except stuff. That's against the law.
You want to do everything except the stuff that's against the law that adults get to do? You want that toothpaste, James? Oop, oop, oop.
Or just like, they get to do a lot of stuff like buy stuff for themselves, get burgers whenever they want, go to fast food places, spend their own money, spend their money when they want to.
Do you think it's better to be a kid or an adult?
An adult.
Why?
Because they get all of the extra privileges.
And it's better for stogging.
Well, that's it for our show this week. My Clean, thank you so much for sharing your work and your wisdom. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in this week. As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. Right now, you could do us a big favor by leaving us a quick review on Apple, because leaving that review really helps other mothers discover the show, and it takes about 30 seconds. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett, with editing from Seaplane Armada. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions, and I am your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.